everyone. This is Amanda Borchel-Dunn, and welcome to the Times of Israel podcast. This week, I'm speaking with sex therapist Dr. Batsheva Marcus, who is the clinical director at New York's Mays Women's Sexual Health Center. Batsheva, who is a practicing modern Orthodox Jew, is also a licensed social worker, and she treats a swath of women, including from the most ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods of New York. Now, listen, this is a very frank, quite explicit conversation about sex, porn, masturbation, and the like. Both of us are middle-aged Jewish women, and the conversation is focused on heterosexual marital sex. But if you're not up for that, and even I was on the verge of my comfort zone here and there, please stop listening now and join us again next week. Now, for those of you who stuck around, Batsheva wrote her doctoral dissertation on women and vibrator use. We'll discuss vibrators, their curious history, and why most ultra-Orthodox rabbis say they are kosher. This upcoming March, Batsheva's new book, Sex Points, will also be published, but here she'll give us a very sneak preview of the system. So enjoy and learn. Hi, Batsheva. Thank you so much for joining me. Where am I finding you today?
I am in Riverdale, New York. So we're in the Bronx.
Oh, excellent. Well, I've never been in the Bronx.
I would say come visit me, but that's kind of not possible right now. But as soon as borders open up, you're always welcome.
Yofi, thanks so much. So we're going to dive right in and basically talk about sex, baby. And to get into more of your particular field, let's remind our listeners of the Unorthodox series, and particularly the scene in which the main character consults a sex therapist and gets some tips. Is that something that you personally have dealt with? Is this a very realistic moment for you?
Oh my God. So the reason I may know more about this film than anybody, I mean, I've just gotten knee deep in this film, is because it is the intersection of my two areas. So I'm a sex therapist. I run Mays Women's Health, which is the largest independent sexual health center in the country. So we do medical and we do psychological. And I see tons of that condition, vaginismus. It's a fairly newly defined condition, and I talk more about it. But also, because I affiliate as modern Orthodox, I have, you know, part of the practice, not a big part because we see everybody and, you know, everybody, you know, in the United States is, but, you know, there's a chunk of both Haredim as well as modern Orthodox people. So I really had, it was an intersection that most people don't get to have, right? The Haredi world and vaginismus treatment. So yes, I feel like that movie, like if I tell you 50 people must have forwarded me, oh my God, Batsheva, did you see this movie? And I'm like, yeah, I did. Not only that, I kind of live this movie. So yeah, so I'm happy to talk about this from any angle you want to talk about this, Amanda.
Okay, excellent. So that's quite interesting. I think for most people who watch the series, obviously, they're not ultra-Orthodox because probably the ultra-Orthodox are not going to be watching the movie. But in shorthand, essentially what happens is this very young bride is not comfortable in any way performing her wifely duty, shall we say. She's a virgin when she marries and she has zero experience. And essentially what happens is it's really, really painful for her. And then she seeks help. So the seeking help, I thought, was quite optimistic. But is that very common?
Oh, okay. So let me just start by then when you say Haredim didn't see this, because I got equal messages that sounded like this. Oh my God, I'm in this community. It was so unfair how they portrayed us. They made us look terrible. And an equal number of, oh my God, I live in this community. It's just this bad, if not worse. So, you know, maybe they didn't do something so wrong there in that series. And I think what I always caution everybody about this girl who was really from a very troubled home, right? This was not a happy family in a happy environment. And so every community has pockets of people who have family trauma and, you know, have troubled families. And I always hazard people. So I thought it was very realistic, but it was realistic with that caveat. Now, she didn't go to a sex therapist, by the way. She went to she went back to her college teacher. I'm just going to tell you. So this young woman had no experience with sex whatsoever, was basically told about sex immediately prior to her marriage to this man or boy she had never met before. And her whole sex education was this very sort of pro forma, bald, erotic-less description by her college teacher. Is that a fair, would you say that was a fair description?
Well, you know, as somebody who actually went through this kind of randomly, because I'm not actually religious, but because I got married in Israel, I needed to get a piece of paper from a college teacher saying that I had been instructed in the ways of the woman. So when it came time for her to talk to me about having sex, I would say, erotic-less is exactly the word, 100%. That is true.
Right. I actually really liked the Kala teacher on this. She was funny and she was very direct, which could have been way worse because some of these Kala teachers are not direct. And then these girls are totally stymied. But really, it was very perfunctory. Like, you do this, you do this, you have holes, this is how it works. And so this young woman is thrust into this situation. What made me really uncomfortable about it, though, is that the pain that she had and the condition that she has, vaginismus, is not just because she was uncomfortable. That does play into a little piece of it, but many of these women manage just fine. It's not good, but they don't have this kind of level of pain. And vaginismus is a very, very common condition. It's like 1 in 10 women. Now, sometimes it's very severe. She had more severe, whatever. This is fantasy, well, but
the mind-body connection as well. I mean, she was so upset in general, so that perhaps.
No, for sure. But the reason I'm like coming back and harping on this is because I feel like there's plenty of women with vaginismus. Again, 1 in 10 women who have good, pretty decent sex education or are fairly comfortable with their bodies. And the muscles are tight. It has to do with where you hold your tension, honestly. So people always assume it's sexual abuse or discomfort with sex. And sometimes that is just often that's not true. And I feel like it comes into blaming the victim again. Like, these poor women have these tight muscles. That's where they're holding their tension. And then we're telling them, oh, it's because you're not either trying hard enough, you're not relaxing, or you're not comfortable, or you don't love him, or your vagina is trying to give you a message. Honestly, it's like back spasms. You know how people have back spasms? People have vaginal spasms. So, and it's so treatable, Amanda. That is, if I had to talk about sort of one of the heartaches of my life, honestly, things that I've seen that break my heart, it's women who feel like it's this black cloud. They feel like there's something wrong with them, that they can't achieve penetration, and they're embarrassed to tell people, and they're scared, and they're panicky, and they stop having any kind of sexual encounters, and it's so easily treatable. I mean, I always tell the story about this patient we had who came in after 11 years of being married. She had stopped having any physical contact with her husband because you start feeling so crummy about yourself. You can have sex without intercourse. So, you know, but she stopped, and he ultimately had an affair, and that's what brought her into her office after 11 years. And 8 weeks later, she was fine. This is not a complicated condition to treat once somebody knows what they're doing. You know, 8 to 12 weeks is what I tell people for the most part. So it breaks my heart because the problems that arise from not treating it are the secondary problems. And so it was great in back to unorthodox. You got me all sidetracked. I'm sorry. I'm talking about the condition. But in unorthodox, she did go back to her Kala teacher, which was great. And the Kala teacher actually knew what vaginismus was, which was also amazing, right? But again, the Kala teacher treated it as if it was sort of a standalone, stick in these dilators with no conversation about the mind, what you said, Amanda, the mind-body connection. And in a certain way, it was the right treatment, just not delivered in the right way. And not to spoiler, but can I do a spoiler alert by the end of
the
show?
You can do a spoiler. It's been long enough.
Okay, I know. I feel like this is an old show, you know? Anyway, but she hooks up with this really cool-looking guy when she gets to Berlin. And that also, honestly, pissed me off a little bit because this was not a case of a woman just having the right partner, right? Like, the suggestion was, oh, as soon as she met somebody who she was attracted to, it wouldn't be a problem. And that is just, again, I feel like it's not fair to the women who suffer with this condition. That's, you know.
Or women in general. I saw that and I was thinking, wow, first time sex with somebody new is not usually that great, in my many, many years ago experience, being married for a long time. But
it's totally true. You're 100% right. You are 100% right. It's like, yes, exactly. So that, again, that's Hollywood. We're allowing, we have to have a certain level of, for Hollywood. But I do feel like, the other thing that people kept bringing up from that show, which I actually didn't think was so off, was the incredible intrusiveness of the family.
that they were so involved in the production of the baby, of the grandchild.
Yes, that his parents knew that they weren't having intercourse, and the mother was putting pressure on her and giving her lube, and you know, the total enmeshment of the family. And at some point, she stands up for herself and says to her husband, "You can't talk to your parents about this. Like, we can't function that way." But that honestly is just not so off. Like, again, not every family. That mother-in-law was particularly horrific, but it was a really interesting show, and it really, really struck a chord with a lot of people, man. I mean, the question is, why do you think it struck such a chord with so many people?
Well, I think personally, as just a woman, you know, not an ultra-Orthodox woman or even a religious woman, just seeing the extremes in the show play out, you can find yourself in some kind of spectrum within these extremes. You know, just thinking back, I'm now 45, but when I was growing up and speaking with my girlfriends about, you know, sex on the horizon or masturbation and things like that, it was not at the same level of conversation that our male peers would be having, because we just didn't know anything about the workings of our body beyond, you know, the diagrams in health class. Sure, we knew where everything was, but we had no idea what was supposed to happen. And I would have to say that out of my peer group, most of us didn't understand what was masturbation until we were, you know, well beyond having sex. You know, we've already had sex several times, and just the idea of masturbation just never occurred to us. So for me, looking at this girl in the program, you know, seeing what she's going through and how clueless she was, and then finally when she does reach some kind of empowerment, it was just a lovely unfolding, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're 100% right. I think that spoke to women, because I think all women, religious, not religious, we don't get good sex education. There's not good sexual health out there. People often dismiss women's pain. And so I think for all those reasons, honestly, it was like a distillation, but it really spoke to women, I think, very powerfully. And, you know, when you say, well, of course we knew where everything was, but we just didn't know what to do with it, which is sort of what you said. Not of course. It's shocking to me in this day and age still how poor our sex education is for boys and for girls. They know different. The boys find things out, but maybe off. They find things out incorrectly. The girls just don't find things out. So sex education, it's the next horizon.
For sure. Now in the program, she had a lot of pain in the intercourse, but I think a lot of women just never even reach orgasm through sex, that they perhaps even go through their whole lives and never ever have an orgasm. So number one, how common is that? Number two, is orgasm actually the goal?
Oh my God, this is like you and I, we could talk an hour on this, but let's suffice it to say this. Let's just define our terms a little bit, okay? So most women, three out of 10 can have an orgasm from sexual intercourse, okay? The other 7 out of 10 are 100% normal and don't have orgasms from intercourse, from a penis and vagina intercourse. If one insists, not you, Amanda, but if one insists on equating sex and sexual intercourse, then you got yourself a problem there, right? And but sex and intercourse are not synonymous. They're not. And the sooner we as people understand that, the better we'll all be. But the stat is that 70 to 80% of women can have an orgasm from either a hand or a mouth, and 94%, give or take, point whatever, can have one from a vibrator.
Okay, so vibrator, that was your doctoral thesis, actually, right?
Yes, it was. I didn't want, go ahead.
And interestingly, they were invented by men, correct, in order to treat hysteria, which is, you know, such a loaded word, hysteria, coming from, you know, the uterus, I believe. Is that correct, the term hysteria?
Yes, it is. God, I feel like you're asking these amazing questions that we could talk about for an hour. There was an amazing book by a woman named Rachel Maines, which she did the entire history of vibrators based on this idea that that it was created by men because women would have these hysterical fits, or they'd be really uncomfortable. They'd have headaches, they'd have tension. And the only way to relieve them were to have these paroxysms, or what we would think of as orgasms, but these sort of shudder releases. And it was so much work for the doctors manually that they invented these vibrating. It was just the same time as Thomas Edison came out with the light bulb. So the electricity allowed for the invention of the vibrator. So that has been the narrative. Somebody came out recently with a research paper sort of disclaiming that. And, you know, look, I was a little heartbroken because it's a great story. And, you know, I have it as part of my dissertation. Not that that was the point of the dissertation, but that it was really, that that's not the case, that it was always used as a sort of pleasure, for a pleasure tool. And it wasn't actually. So I don't have definitive information for you on that, but I will tell you that the more we are willing to talk about sex as a wide experience that involves hands, mouth, penis, vagina, parts of your the rest of your body, you know, 100 other parts of your body, and fun things, including vibrators, then most women do orgasm, and they will orgasm during sex. They just won't orgasm necessarily during intercourse unless they're also using their hand in there or a vibrator up against their clitoris.
So, and is that kosher, meaning in Jewish sex, you know, for people who definitely go through the nidah period, the separation, the ritual purity, people who are concerned with Jewish law, halakha, is it anything goes? Is anything off the table in terms of Jewish law in sex?
So Amanda, you know better than to ask if there's a yes or no question about that. You know that, right? There's 10 rabbis and 10 opinions. But
well, you're my rabbi today.
Okay, so I do a podcast called The Joy of Text, where that's all we talk about, me and Rabbi Dov Linzer. We talk about Judaism and sexuality and all of these issues. And we have lots of episodes on vibrators and masturbation. And so I will tell you, of most, I would say like 99% of the rabbis I talk to, and I do talk to many because I, you know, end up with patients who want me to talk to the rabbis, they have no problem with the use of a vibrator. It's fascinating. And certainly not with the woman using her own hand while she's having intercourse. Most of them are fine with the man using their hand too. Ironically, it's like looking at the vulva, that's where questions kind of arise. But for the most part, I would say the more educated and comfortable a rabbi is with the subject of sex, and that could be super, super fromm and super, super charedi, the more lenient they are. You know, there's definitely voices in the Talmud and the halacha that say, really, as long as it's between a husband and wife and it causes pleasure for the two of them, everything goes and everything's fine. And then you do have more conservative perspectives that say, well, this may be okay and that may not be okay. So, but I will say the vibrator question is a fascinating one because for some reason, a lot of rabbis are much more comfortable with that than they are with, I had one really charedi patient. She was the daughter of some Hasidic rabbi and her husband was, and I loved her. She was adorable. And she literally had 5 kids before she knew where her clitoris was. So you just get a sort of sense, you know? And she was really invested in wanting to have a good sexual relationship with her husband and came in because she was not having any pleasure. And so we went through lots of things, and I will tell you what was fascinating to me in her case, because some patients are like, if you tell me it makes sense, I'll do it. Some discuss it with their husbands. She wanted to ask the rabbi every single tiny detail, and he was fine with the vibrator, or okay with the vibrator, I should say. He was much less comfortable with her buying sexy lingerie, which honestly, that was like years ago. And so I've sort of come around to understanding where that's coming from. But this is, again, the idea of viewing, the husband looking at her somehow lustfully, that made him really uncomfortable. One of the things she and I talked about was that when I talk to women about buying sexy clothing, it's really because it turns them on more than because it turns their partner on, right? So that was a little bit of a discussion with the Rav. And I think eventually he came around. She didn't even need to buy like, you know, a sheer teddy. She just was going to wear a t-shirt with a slightly lower neck. Do you know what I mean? Like that was erotic for her and turned her on. And that's where we were trying to go.
Listen to Decision Points, a podcast that shares engaging stories about key Israeli and Arab leaders, featuring interviews with guests who knew them personally. Join me, David Murkowski of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, to go on a journey through history.
It's fascinating. how one thing can turn somebody on, one thing cannot. You know, I think about often, since I'm raising three boys and three girls, porn, you know, because my teenage boys have reached the age that they're in the bathroom for a really long time. And I'll just leave it at that. But I always wonder, in the shower for a very long time. And I always wonder about the relationship between men versus women to something like porn or the sexy lingerie and things like that. For me, you know, I'm such a schlumpy kind of dresser. I mean, anything that is constricting or uncomfortable, I'm like, this is not sexy. This is no. But as you're saying, you know, the long V-neck t-shirt could do it for some person, and porn does it for a lot of people, essentially, because it's a gazillion dollar industry. But is there any kind of biological or gender relationship to porn that you know about?
So the studies that have been done show that men are much more attracted to erotica when it's visual. That's what you think of as classic porn. Women actually spend just as much time and just as much money on storylines that are pornographic, right? So Literotica is a huge successful website. Like, so the same amount of hours online and the same amount of dollars are spent on a different kind of porn for women. Women seem to engage much more in the wanting to be wanted, right? Like this lustful, like turning somebody on, being desired by an alpha male. You know, think of 50 Shades of Grey. Oh, that was porn for women. I mean, that was porn for women. So when you say something biological, I think, you know, it's easier for the men to kind of access the kind of porn that they like and know it and understand it. But I don't think women, I don't see women as being kind of uninterested in those kind of sexual things. I do think I'm going to like pivot a little here as a mother of three boys, you said?
Yes. And three boys, three girls. Yeah.
Three boys, three girls. So let's just talk for a minute. I don't want to steal your mic here, but you need to be talking to your kids about porn.
We talk about it.
Okay, great. Because I cannot tell you how many parents don't talk about it because they're convinced that their kids haven't seen any, right? And okay. I will tell you, I promise anybody listening, their child, if the child is over nine, has experienced and seen porn. And the only way to inoculate your kids from the realities of porn is to talk to them about it. It's not to pretend it doesn't exist, but talk to them about what's real and what isn't real and what's Hollywood and what's not Hollywood and why it's attractive and why it may not be. And, you know, and
unrealistic expectations. That's some of the
totally. There's a camera angle there that's working for 20 minutes to get that camera angle. And there's medications that the men are taking to be able to hold their erection. So, you know, and this makes parents so uncomfortable, Amanda. Like I just, more than anything, it makes them so uncomfortable and I get it, but I feel like the only way to be able to make sure that your kids can be able to handle porn and know when maybe it's becoming a problem and maybe it's not is if you talk about it.
Oh, 100%. They're embarrassed, obviously, but we talk about all of this very frankly in our household and menstruation and everything. The boys and the girls get the talk.
That's amazing. And yes, they're going to be really embarrassed. They're going to look away. You're going to think they're not listening. They're hearing every word. And good for you, Amanda. That's amazing. Did your parents do that? Is that why you're so able to do that?
You know, I shared a wall with my parents. And one day when I was quite young, I was bouncing on their bed. And I was like, oh, this is the sound that I hear at night. And my mom said something to the effect of, when you don't hear it, that's when you know there's a problem. And so,
oh my God.
I must have been probably about 10 or so at that point.
Uh-huh. Oh my God. I love that story. I have this other story, which I feel like most of my stories have already been told. And then sometimes I don't tell stories because I don't want to embarrass my kids who are all adults at this point. But this one, I don't think I've ever told the story, which is that my son, when he was about 15, and he was big, and he like came running into my bedroom and he leapt onto the bed. And all of a sudden he heard so a vibrator that had been plugged in was under the bed. And my husband and I were standing there and we just burst out laughing. And I said, oh, I think that was my back massager. And I pulled it out and it was a back massager anyway. And he wasn't an idiot. He got it. Because, you know, the one thing I always feel strongly about is I talk to my kids about everything, but I don't give them details about my sex life. I feel like that's not helpful to them. They don't want to hear it and it's not helpful for kids. So anyway, but that is a great story. And I love that story about your mom. Love that story about your mom. I'm going to file that one away. I hope I can use it in the future.
Please do. She would love it.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Now, just pivoting again a little bit, we were talking earlier about how only 30% of women generally have an orgasm just through intercourse without any kind of intervention. And I've always wondered about nature versus nurture in this, meaning it seems that nature has given men this incredible ability to have so much fun so quickly and women not. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that or if that's something that's occurred to you.
I think I'd push back first on your term intervention. Like you said, women need an intervention. It's not an intervention. Like women orgasm very well and very easily in the way they're supposed to orgasm. And so it's just that it doesn't happen in the way that's best for men necessarily. So I just need to, I feel like we have a very androcentric view of sex, you know, like it's very, very male oriented. Like I often joke around, if you ask 10 people on the street, like, what are the minimum requirements for something to be called sex? Most people would say, man puts his penis, again, this is going to be very like, you know, binary, but man puts his penis in women's vagina, man ejaculates, that's sex.
Even after Clinton, that seems so ridiculous.
You're right, but most people would not say to you, oral sex. Do you know what I mean? Like most people would say, you know, anything, whatever. So I feel like we still have a very, very kind of male-centered view. So women orgasm one way, men another, and you're saying it's so easy for them to have pleasure. But the truth is that men have a refractory period, right? Like except for 18-year-old boys, most men cannot have a second erection quickly after their first erection, right? Like, yeah, I would say after maybe age 22 or so, most men at normal age, you know, middle-aged men, it takes a while, like a couple hours the next day, whereas women could have 20 orgasms if they want it. Now, again, not all women, but many, many women women are much more likely to be multi-orgasmic than men.
Which again, I always wonder what is the natural process here? Where's the natural selection in giving us this kind of evolutionary ability to eat more at the smorgasbord than the men can?
Because I wonder if, there's a book called The Big Book of Orgasm, I think, that where they really did try to look at orgasm. It's been so many years since I read this, from every single angle of like, biological, hereditary, like what purpose does it serve? Usually orgasm involves, not always, but usually it involves vaginal uterine contractions, which could move the sperm higher up into the uterus, more likely for pregnancy. One could just argue that if it was pleasurable, a woman would be much more likely to be willing to engage in sexual activity with a male partner in order to have kids. I don't know, but you know what, Amanda, I'm going to say something really radical now. I don't care. Like like my job right now is always to take a woman and say to her, you can have a good sex life. You know, it's within the realm and you can have an orgasm. You can, which that's true about 94% of women. I don't know about the other 6%. Still working on that. But why and how, that's interesting. I mean, that's being left for more the sociologists than for me. So I'm not going to be super helpful on that one. I'm sorry.
No, fair enough. Obviously when you're in a married kind of situation, your primary purpose is to have sex with your partner, not alone, you know, and it's often somewhat uncomfortable for a woman to direct her partner to give her the pleasure that she desires. As one of my friends put it, something like, it's just easier to steer the ship myself. Okay. And yet I think a lot of women have the desire to have their partner give them the fulfillment that they want. What do you suggest in this kind of situation if plain out communication isn't working?
So I'm a very big believer in women showing their partner what they need to do, and for women to be able to touch themselves too. We need to really think about what sex should look like, right? So in a perfect world, sex is an activity where you're both having fun, you're both feeling good, you're both turned on, and you both have orgasms. And you asked before, like how important is orgasms? And let's table that for a minute. We can talk about it, but that can come in so many different ways. And there's no reason a woman can't use her own hand on herself, either during intercourse or before or after, or use a vibrator on herself. But that doesn't mean that it's the same thing as if you're alone in your room using your vibrator. You still have a person there talking to you, touching other parts of your body. We have to, again, I think we do a much better job having a good sex life if we're willing to expand our view of what sex looks like. So let's say you're somebody who likes to have an orgasm before you're a woman, before intercourse with your husband or your partner, and you guys are fooling around, you're really turned on, you use your hand, you have an orgasm, he watches, he's now really turned on, and he, you know, enters you, then you could maybe have another orgasm afterwards, either with his hand or his mouth or your hand. Like, it's just a variation of a theme where we have to stop thinking about it so linearly, right? Like penis and vagina, him creating the orgasm. It's just an experience that you're both in together. And, you know, I feel like I'm frothing at the mouth here, but we talked about my PhD thesis was on vibrators with women. And one of the big questions that came up was, you know, how their husbands would feel about, like, I was interested in if a woman wants to use a vibrator, like, what are the issues that come up for her? That was the question of my dissertation. And it was qualitative. So, one of the issues that I found most sort of interesting and amusing was almost every woman who I interviewed said they would have no problem talking to their husband about the vibrator. So I did these interviews prior to introducing the vibrator, gave them a vibrator, and then checked in with them again 6 or 8 weeks later. So all of the women who said they would have no problem talking to their husband, like 80% did not talk to their husband about it, right? Like somehow it was harder than they thought it was to bring up the vibrator. And the comments that I got were things like, how do you even bring it into a conversation? You know, like, hi, honey, I did the laundry, I took the kids to school, and I bought a vibrator. Like, how do you even introduce it into conversation? Or I'm afraid that he's going to feel like he's unnecessary. And what I feel like is that this has so much to do with reframing things and conversations about reframing things. Because if you're having fun with somebody else and you're using the vibrator, that is not the same experience as being alone in a room with the vibrator, right? Which is a great thing too. I'm not knocking sex for one person. That's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. But that's a different experience. Women understand it better when I talk about male masturbation, right? It is likely that your husband can masturbate quicker, more efficiently, and possibly have a better orgasm all by himself, right? But he wants to have sex with you. And why does he want to have sex with you? Because it's about something much bigger than that. It's there's something pleasurable about connecting with another human being as part of that experience. It's the only experience where we essentially get naked with somebody else. And I mean that figuratively, not just physically.
Right. So we bare our souls.
Yeah, you bare your whole. I mean, when you think about the idea of having an orgasm with somebody else in the room, like that is like a level of trust that you just, and it's intimacy. That is when you talk about intimacy with somebody else. And that I think is why sex is so powerful. So using a vibrator or using your hand with your partner there, talking to you, touching you, watching you, fantasizing with you, whatever, however, and whenever you do it, like that is a different experience, but it's a good experience. And we have to stop thinking about the fact that if you are using the vibrator or you are guiding his hand or you are, you know, suggesting how to be touched, that's in any way less than sex. Like that is great sex. And that is really, I think, where we have to start kind of shipping our brains have to start moving in that direction.
That's fantastic. Now that everyone is home all the time home, and in Israel, we're just coming out of yet another lockdown. Some of my girlfriends are saying, when can we have sex? Because everyone is home all the time and they're not going to bed either. So what do you think about, I don't know, appointment sex or subterfuge sex or what? I mean, how can you get it in when everyone is around all the time?
Oh my God, Amanda, that is such a great question. And I wish I had a great answer. It's so funny. I have a book coming out, we can talk about that, but I have a book coming out in March called Sex Points, Reclaim Your Sex Life with the Revolutionary New Point System. But one of the chapters is about sex with kids and how when your kids are really, that kids are their own unbelievable challenge, which, well, you have six. So like, why? Well, I don't have to tell you, you could write the book on this, right? Like, so when they're little, you're exhausted, you have no energy, you're dripping from every orifice, like you're just not. When they're bigger, like, and then when they're bigger, like they go to bed later than you, they're sitting right outside your door, like there's all of these other, you know, conflicting issues going on. So you asked me, how do I feel about like scheduled sex? I think that's what you asked me. And I would say to you that I feel like scheduled sex is the most important cornerstone, the most important cornerstone. If you want to maintain a long, ongoing monogamous relationship, scheduling, if you think you're going to do it without scheduling sex, I got news for you. It just ain't going to happen. It is not going to happen. And our ridiculously romanticized views that sex should be this like crazy spontaneous, like, oh my God, is
tear your clothes off as you're coming up the stairs.
Totally. Or even, you know, I'm climbing to bed and oh my God, all of a sudden there's 17 things in my head, but I'm going to knock them out and want to have sex. Like, it is just, people who think that that's going to happen are the people who have no sex life. Just telling you that now. And when I interview people who have long-term ongoing sex lives, every one of them has it scheduled, whether they are aware of it or not. And that's what I think is really fascinating. Like, somebody will say to me, I'll say, how often do you have sex? And she'll say, well, we pretty much do it every weekend, or, you know, we do it in the weekend and usually maybe Tuesday or Wednesday, or usually we don't let more than 4 or 5 days go by or something like that. Like, there's something that's happening that triggers in their brain that it's time to have sex. And if you don't schedule it, it is not going to happen. And for the people out there who say, oh my God, Bacheva, that sounds so unromantic, I will tell you, you know what's unromantic? Not having any sex in your life. That's unromantic. But if you have scheduled regular sex, sometimes it will be fabulous. Sometimes it will be fine and fun and okay, and that's fine. But sometimes it will be fabulous. But the people who aren't scheduling it aren't having any sex. So it's not like they're having fabulous sex. So that is really, again, I feel like, Amanda, I feel like we have to shift our thinking on so many things. We have these crazy romanticized views about sex at the same time as we have these sort of crazy pornographic views about sex and these very antiquated ideas about sex. So scheduled, the first thing I would say to parents, first thing is sit down, talk to each other. When do you think we could fit something in here? Like, is there a time the kids are all watching television? Do we want to wake up in the middle of the night when we know kids are sleeping? Do you want me to wake you up early in the morning? Like, do we have to meet? Do we have to be rendezvous in the shower? You know, can we take the shower back from the boys for a half hour?
No, not their shower.
Yes, your shower. You take the shower back from the boys. Like, you know, so scheduling sex is just tantamount. It's the most important thing you can do. So that was it. And then when you said clandestine sex, oh my God, that's awesome. If you guys can figure out like where in your world you can find a place that is, you know, the office. If somebody's working right now in an office and they're by themselves or after hours in an office, offices can be very sexy places because you see each other differently in an office. So yeah, that's a long answer to a short question, Amanda.
No, it's a fabulous answer. And I think a lot of people will appreciate it, especially today when it's so, it's hard to be intimate with anyone when you know the world is falling apart, as somebody said to me recently. And when you have that person that you want to be intimate with, you have to find the time and the space. So it's fantastic. Do give us a bit of a sneak preview of your book that's coming out in March.
So I said, it's called Sex Points. The idea, Amanda, is that most women who have problems with their sex lives, and that's most women, know that something's the matter, but often can't identify exactly what is going on. Like they have like problems with desire or arousal, or they're having some pain, or they can't quite orgasm anymore, and they don't know what's going wrong. So it's very hard to try to fix it. And so the book opens with a 32-question questionnaire, which at the end of that questionnaire, you end up with scores on four quadrants of your sex life, with desire, wanting to have sex, arousal, getting turned on, pain, sort of speaks for itself, and orgasm. And now you see where you're missing points. So you've got a point score on each of these. And it'll be really clear to you where you're missing the points, and much more importantly, how that's affecting other areas. So the problem may start in area A, but your missing points there are affecting you on points B or C or D. So now you have a really clear, or hopefully a very clear snapshot view of what's happening with your sex life. And then most of the book is dedicated to actually giving you points back in all of those quadrants. So they're very practical day-to-day suggestions. And it really marries, because this is what I do that nobody else does, that our center does, that nobody else does, the physiological and the psychological. We live in a world where we like to make that, you know, split. It's a little disingenuous,
right, because people talk about my body, blah, 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 but I, blah, blah, blah.
Totally. Or I can't turn my head off. My head just goes going. It's a psychological problem. I can't. Right. I'm like, really? Because what do you think is making things happen in your head, right? Like, that's hormones. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the medications that you're on that could be affecting you, the medications you could consider that may be helping you, your fantasy life, vibrators, your relationship, all of those intermix to come up with the solutions for you. And that's, hopefully the book is broken down in a way that makes it manageable for women to really, really address and fix their sex life. That's my hope. And maybe you'll have me back in March to talk more about it, because I could talk and talk and talk about it.
And I could hear and hear and hear, and I look forward to it greatly. Thank you so much, Batsheva. Really, it's been so informative and fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the Times of Israel podcast, and thanks to TLV1 Studios for sound help and the Diva Family Band for the music. If you like what you hear, please subscribe wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this is Amanda Borshaldan. Shalom.
I had a lot of fun, lots of laughs. I hope you did too.